Is that bi-directional?
Yeah, I've got it set to 2-channel, which means that it basically is like 290s. Cool. Yeah, I can set it to 4-channel. I think that just repeats the two. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But that it takes up more space on the card. And we can't ramble and ramble, which is nice. Okay, welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight we got Michael and Malcolm. And you guys want to talk about David Lynch Dune from 1984?
Do you want to do that and segue into the other things? You want to do the Dune first?
We can just do them as separate things. Oh, okay. And break them up or however you want to do it. So from 1984 tonight, we're going to talk about David Lynch. David Lynch's adaptation of Frank Herbert's
It was 1984?
Dune. I think it was 1984.
You know that just off the top of your head?
I have weird memory for certain things, especially in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could be wrong. It could have been 83. I don't know, whatever. Mm. 83 was Return of the Jedi. 82 was Blade Runner and Star Trek 2. And a couple of... I mean, there was, like, a good collection of, like, sci-fi fantasy stuff in that sort of post-Star Wars thing where there was all kinds of, you know, shit like Krull was being made.
Krull? Yeah.
Good times with Krull.
Well, Sting was pretty sexy in it.
Yeah, you got Sting as the, Baron Harkonnen's nephew, along with that other guy.
Saw him a couple times in that kind of weird Art Deco Speedo.
Art Deco Speedo.
Wings coming off the hips.
The famous line, I will kill you!
Yeah.
He was just crazy the whole time.
Uh-huh.
He's been in a few other things, but that, I think, Sting was in that, and then I don't think he was in much for a while. I mean, he was in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. He was like the dad, the bartender dad.
Oh, really? Huh. I didn't notice.
Which was kind of an odd one. But yeah, I haven't seen him in too many other things.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting casting. You got Brad Dourif as one of the, what do they call them, Mega Knights or something like that?
Yeah.
We got the cut with stained lips and they drink the weird stuff.
Yeah.
Kyle MacLachlan, a Lynch staple. Mm-hmm. You got Captain Picard as the weapons instructor.
Oh, yeah.
You get Al from Quantum Leap, Dean Stockwell as
the traitor.
The traitor. You get Jürgen from Das Boot, among other things.
Oh,
as,
really?
As the Duke. Duke Atreides.
That's what he's from.
Or was he the Duke, or was Paul the Duke?
No, Paul wasn't the Duke.
Yeah, the guy was the Duke.
Yeah. Interesting. There is also
Sean Young
from Twin Peaks, whatever his name is.
Yeah, the old guy talking about the percolator.
No. He was
because he's in it too. I think.
Yeah,
too.
Eraserhead's in it.
Eraserhead guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Ed, the
he
guy
was
that
the
was
leader
married
of the
Arconians. Woman with the patch.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Twin Peaks. He's the leader of the Arconians.
Yeah.
And Jose Ferreira.
Yeah.
Classic actor was the Emperor. Is that what they called him?
Yeah, the Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I mean, I think the reason a lot of people, like, especially on the internet, are... I mean, I think there's two schools of people that don't like the Lynch Dune. There's the hardcore sci-fi people that, like, have seen the books and seen the complexity in the books and have seen, like, the sci-fi miniseries and then the Children of Dune one that expands upon that, where there's much more political intrigue and complexity going on there that this movie doesn't really hit upon very well. And then there's probably a whole collection of people that have heard the stories about the planning that went into the 70s version that was going to be made, where Salvador Dali was going to play the Emperor, and H.R. Giger was doing all these designs, and instead of Toto, they were going to have Pink Floyd do the soundtrack. I mean, there's just like this crazy confluence of stuff that sounded like this could be awesomely crazy.
I have never heard of this before.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. Yeah. I read it on an IMDb trivia or something. So, I mean, who knows? I'm sure Wikipedia would have pages of stuff now. But yeah, so instead, what you get something that's much more. I mean, I don't know. It's an offbeat '80s adventure movie to me, and I look at it as that, and I keep it that simple and.
It
I enjoy
like,
it.
It felt like Willy Wonka in space.
Yeah. I mean, it's I like the Toto soundtrack. I think that it's got these moments of kind of offbeat electronic score from like those 80s bands, and it's also got like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. I kind of have a fondness for that kind of music. I guess maybe because it would
the score was good.
Be early nostalgia for me. Having been born in 81, I would be 3 when this movie came out. It used to be on late night on the Disney Channel of all channels.
Really?
All the time. Like almost every Saturday night it was on at like 11 o'clock at night on the Disney Channel.
It's a pretty bizarre movie to be on the Disney Channel.
It's kind of gross.
This was way before, this was when the Disney Channel was basically just like Disney cartoons and other reruns of certain like Disney properties before they had this whole original programming block and they had they had their like their tweener slut line that they were rolling out every 6 weeks, you know, where it's like the new chick that has a dumb show and then is also a singer and then is also going to do movies and then you know they kind of process them.
Like Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah, like Lindsay Lohan, like
Montana.
Haley Joel, whatever. I mean, you know, who knows? But yeah, I remember seeing it there. I think I saw it on TV on some other channel before
that's
then.
That's odd, because it's kind of, the whole tone of the movie is pretty weird and creepy.
It's very weird.
And the Baron is like this gross guy.
Yes.
He's got like this thing for boys.
I mean, I'm sure that
like
the Disney Channel, the Disney Channel edit, I have no doubt cut a good portion of that out, even though it was airing late at night. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it falls into that category of like sets and design, and I mean, like the costumes are cool, and the world is—it's a peek into a pretty well realized world. It's not this thorough examination of it. I mean, it's not a miniseries, so it's not going to get that dense into all of these other things. And frankly, for what it is, I think it's just fine. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And
right, well. Yeah, if you look at it as just a standalone sci-fi flick, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
But when people start comparing it to the book, and it's like, almost with any book, it's like, what's the point? Because the book is long. It's like 300 and...
Have you read the book?
I listened to it on tape.
So then, yeah, you've experienced the book.
I've experienced the book, but the actual book, I own the actual book. It's near 400 pages.
Yeah.
It's
For a book, that's not crazy long. That's not like a Harry Potter book.
No, it's not War and Peace or anything, but it's pretty long, and there is a ton of inner monologue, because everything is about having the spies and having your brain in hands and seeing beyond normal human perception, and so there's all this like inner
psychedelic stuff.
Yeah, and then that translates in as being a lot of voiceover.
Yeah,
in the movie,
yeah,
people,
good
like,
bit of
staring
it, yeah.
off in space and like, yeah, and thinking these.
I thought the voiceover worked for the most part. I thought that it said bits about the characters and things. It wasn't just pure exposition. I mean, though sometimes it was clearly exposition. It was like, oh, it's that person who is this of that.
Right.
You know?
Well,
which
you almost
which
have
you,
to
you,
do
yeah,
to, like,
it's so complex.
Nail
so
down plot
going on.
Points and progress the story.
Yeah.
Because it is a very expansive plot. And there's Paul Muad'Dib's sister.
Yeah.
Who is like this weird child prodigy. In the book, that is expanded a lot more. And she's like this incredible oracle.
And then they keep going with the books. I've seen, I watched the sci-fi miniseries and then the follow-up miniseries, Children of Dune. And yeah, they go some pretty crazy places with it. I mean, not I don't know, not really, but it, I mean, the Children of Dune is like his children. And the sister ends up becoming kind of corrupted, and he ends up, it's like, you know, like a blind man in the wasteland. And all of this stuff that you're kind of like, okay, I guess that's where the story goes, and there's some interesting stuff there, but...
Yeah, well, Herbert wrote the first three, right? And then his son took over and did a bunch of stuff.
Possibly, yeah. It's, I mean, like most of these sci-fi series, I always hear people... Rarely have I heard of a sci-fi series or fantasy series or anything that's just good all the way through. And a lot of them are, like, still going, but so-and-so's son or some other guy co-writes it now or whatever, and it's just like,
anytime
whatever.
A sibling, relative, whatever, takes over a series, it's like... To me, it feels like just clearly like milking the
like
cow
cash
for some money. You know, it's like, oh, come on, you know, it's don't ruin a good thing.
Yeah.
Do
your own stuff. Come on.
Yeah. The set design on the movie was incredible, I thought.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
All the set design, costume design, I thought it was awesome. They had some crazy digital effects that were like groundbreaking for the day, which was their force field suits, where it was like this geometric.
Oh, yeah, those were like
the
total
body.
Old school, yeah.
Yeah, and back then, apparently, that was some hot stuff.
That was pretty big. I mean, that was a couple years after Tron, which did some pretty cool stuff in that same vein, but yeah.
Yeah, that
and,
was pretty neat.
I mean, my thing is that when you get directors that have, that are like auteurs, and especially someone like Lynch, who is so focused on, I mean, like, he's a painter and stuff, I mean, he's really aware of, like, texture and color and tone, light. Tone and light and everything. I love to see them work within the spectacle of science fiction and stuff. I mean, Ed Lynch really only, I mean, he's kind of dabbled in that with a few other things. sort of, kind of, more towards his, you know, strange noir sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the only proper science fiction movie that David Lynch has ever done. And so I just kind of like it for that. I mean, it makes he makes it his own thing. He makes it unique.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the worms are just this such a crazy thing. It's so frightening and grotesque, but then it's also something that they harness. And and like you said, like the landscapes and stuff are just really cool. It's got such a distinct mood. To me, like, the experience of watching the movie, like, it puts you in a certain kind of place and mood that I like. I mean, that you know, that's what I'm looking for in a movie. I could hyper-analyze every little nook and cranny
it's
about it.
It's definitely an interesting mood. For me, movies are represented by, like, a specific color. To me, that color is, like, a brown. It's like a brown, a golden brown.
Lynch? This one? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because of the deserts and stuff. I mean, but it does change. I mean, you know, you have... Arrakis is where it never rains, but then you have the planet where it's the water, and that's where they're coming from, and there's a lot of sort of dark blacks and almost steely colors there, with a lot of gilded silver, you know, gilded stuff, too, I guess. But, yeah, then once they get to the desert, it seems like it gets like there's a lot of stone when they're with the Fremen or whatever.
Yeah.
And then they get the acoustic weapons, which is kind of cool and unique. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's cheesy too. It's like you scream and that makes it realize.
That was one thing in the book. It was a little bit more developed. How the technology they were using was more of an amplification of what you were generating within your own body, kind of like this chi kind of.
Yeah,
thing.
I know. I think they convey that to some degree, but they don't make a big deal of it.
Yeah. Yeah. For a Lynch film, it didn't feel very Lynchy. I mean, there was, like, some creepy weirdness to it, but it really wasn't that bizarre. As bizarre as I think, you know, most Lynch films are, aside from The Straight Story, of course.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't it the movie he made directly after Elephant Man?
It might have been. Yeah.
So this was when, I think, Elephant Man was his first big
film.
I mean, he did Eraserhead, and then I think he did Elephant Man.
And he was working with, like, people like Dino De Laurentiis, who was trying to make all of these big movies.
Right.
And these. So I have no doubt that there was probably a degree of which it's Lynch's movie and a degree of which it's a big Hollywood movie.
It's interesting that they entrusted such an sci-fi epic to David Lynch, being that he was, you know, fairly...
Yeah.
Well, but then, like, they did that with Elephant Man, and he showed his, like, he proved his weight with Elephant Man, so they were like, okay, here's this.
But
it's before he got super weird.
That's true.
Well,
even though Eraserhead was weird.
Yeah, I mean, basically they had Eraserhead, and pretty much that was about it. I mean, I think the thing is, it's just everyone... Elephant Man was Mel Brooks, the comedian.
Produced it.
And so he's the one that chose Lynch to direct it. So he, within his comedic sensibilities or whatever else, had this meeting with Lynch, and Lynch is in a jacket, you know, a leather jacket, just kind of being Lynch about things. And, you know, he saw that this guy could do this, and so that was how that happened. I mean, and I guess it did financially really well, but it was not a blockbuster. I mean, what Malcolm's saying is, like, yeah, there is... That is pretty big deal that they trusted him to do it, but there weren't a huge number of people back then. I mean, I would doubt he was their first choice. They probably wanted someone like Spielberg or something, and he might have been working on Temple of Doom at the time. I almost feel like that's a story, that is actually possibly a situation that happened. But yeah, it wasn't like now when there's like hundreds of these jobbers that grew up watching all these movies and will go and make Die Hard 4 or make X-Men 3 or make whatever, you know? I mean, which is, you know... What so many of these comic book and sci-fi movies have become is just these kind of... They're not being made so much by auteurs that are putting their own angle on it. Not that they ever could be, because it's so much money that it has to be watered down. And that's probably what happened with Lynch's vision, you know, sensibilities for the film, too. I mean, you know that there's, like, a four-hour cut that's got incomplete visual effects that's directed by Alan Smithy, which is the title you put on when you don't want your name taken off. That was released for, like, TV broadcasts and stuff. To try and make it more epic. It's got more material in it.
Oh, really?
But it's not the version. It's not... Like, the DVD version is the Lynch version. The version that starts with the princess talking is Lynch's version.
Okay.
The version that starts with, like, drawings, like, colored drawings.
Huh.
That was the one that was always on, like, Sci-Fi Channel.
Is there a way we can see this?
I don't know how you would be able to see it.
I didn't know
it
was a full version.
Yeah, it's just a longer version, and okay. I mean, it's not Lynch's version.
Maybe if you buy the special edition DVD or something.
Yeah, I don't remember what it adds or what it really does for it, but, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's one of those things like with Blade Runner almost, where there's so many different versions that people get a little incredulous about, like, the ultimate vision, you know, it becomes a little incoherent.
Huh. I wonder how many movies there are, how many Lynch movies are where he makes an appearance, a little cameo.
Yeah.
Because he was in this one,
as a little Spice Miner or something.
Yeah. Well, you'll know because his voice is very distinct.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe a couple. A lot, I mean, and you never really do know how much of that is like a director's little bit of a director ego, or it's just like that day the guy that was supposed to be the Spice Miner didn't show up. He went out with his old lady the night before and just, you know, tied one off and...
Could be.
Was at the cockfights, half passed out, you know, because they shot it down in Mexico.
How funny.
See what I mean? I'm already writing a story there for that character that who knows, right?
Who directed Moby Dick? John Huston.
I just watched Moby Dick.
Oh, cool.
Which is just kind of a side note, but there were a lot of actors after he'd filmed that weren't available, and so John Huston dubs a lot of the characters in that movie.
That's weird. That's very strange.
He's
because he's got such a distinct voice, I can't see him doing other voices than his own John Huston voice.
He's about four characters in Moby Dick.
But they all sound like John Huston?
I guess, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
In a hole. In a tiny little hole. Because he did the narration for the Hobbit cartoon back in the day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy.
Could be, yeah.
But I mean, yeah, I don't know what else to say about the Lynch Dune. I own it, and I'll probably pop it in.
To me, it is kind of a hard movie
years.
To watch. Like, I definitely have to be in the mood for it.
Yeah.
There were things that didn't make sense to me.
Like
that wormy thing with the hands. Like, what did he have to do with anything?
Wormy thing with the hands?
With the big forehead, who's like, you must kill.
Oh yeah, I forget what his significance is.
Talking about the things in the vat.
That looks like a vagina.
The giant brain vaginas in the vat. Yeah.
The brain vagina.
Those are the like over evolved. Those are the. That's like the guild of.
Okay.
Of the,
right.
the guys that fold. They show a couple of them with the giant cylinder when the Dukes when the Atreides go to Arrakis
can fold space and time.
They're the only they have all the power because I mean it's basically
a question.
It's a metaphor for like oil or anything else.
But why did they want him killed?
Because
he knew that he'd become this great prophet with immense power and start disrupting things. So like we gotta snuff this.
Yeah, he would create. I mean, if the people of Arrakis, the Fremen or whatever, threw off the yoke of imperial control, then they could have a corner on the spice market and disrupt everything. I mean, it's just resource acquisition. It's like if the like World War I or whatever, like if the Arabian thing got together in a certain way and was stabilized in a certain way, then all the oil that's there would, you know, be controlled by a given entity and it would... I mean, and that's really what it is.
I think the most pertinent question the movie poses is if you could travel through space and time and were basically this, you know, all-powerful brain... Would you be willing to do that and sacrifice, you know, becoming looking like a brain vagina?
Yeah.
to you?
I mean,
would you be willing to be a brain vagina and be able to transcend time and space?
The longer version with the pictures and stuff at the opening does give you a little more information about all the different groups and kind of, I mean, you get this whole thing that's probably from the book about how this is crazy far in the future and humans have had like complete reliance on computers and then the robo-apocalypse and then no computers and so now they have the certain people that take that drink the red stuff and they're like human computers and the way that the culture is kind of completely evolved and so I don't know if those brain things evolved from people over like a zillion generations or what I mean like so but it wasn't I don't think it's like you give a regular person enough spice and they turn into that. I never quite figured that was what it was.
Yeah, there were some. Speaking of those montages where the little worm creature is kind of going through space and time, or whatever. There are some kind of interesting special effects where it looks like they had vats of some kind of swirly, viscous stuff with particles in it. That was kind of neat.
Yeah, no, I mean...
There's some cool old effects in there.
There's some good visuals. This is the kind of thing, if I saw this as being like a midnight movie thing, I'd go check out a print of this and see how it looked and how it played.
Why did the princess open it?
It's weird. I don't know why. She becomes much more relevant. I mean, in the book, she's more relevant, and in the miniseries, she is. He actually ends up marrying her for like a political union, and then taking on the other one, Sean Young, as his concubine. You know, old time style, men can do what they want kind of stuff. You know, but that obviously didn't happen in this one. Or maybe it's sort of implied vaguely at the end, where I think the princess is standing by him. Because the Emperor comes to the whole, you know, everyone shows up at the end, and he has that fight with Sting and all that, and then it starts to rain, and you're like, okay, wow, that's the end of that movie. it leaves things left to be said, but I don't know. I just have a great fondness for most, even if they're not good, like I mentioned Kroll kind of jokingly. You know, they were all trying so hard and so earnestly, for the most part, to create like some kind of a fun or thought-provoking or both kind of action-adventure movies in the 80s. Right. I mean, you know, so you have the big scores or the interesting scores, and you have the sets, and you have the vast landscapes that they actually went out and shot in. And
that's probably part of our appreciation, being that we've all worked in film to some degree, appreciate all the effort that goes into something like this.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, it kind of can work both ways. When something is just terrible, you can just be like, wow, all of that, and it's that. I feel that quite a few times. Like, I felt that about Avatar, and like, all of that, and it's that. Why?
Yeah.
Come on, man. Every time... And always, like it's what makes me so nervous about Nolan's movies, Chris Nolan's movies, is I always feel like one of these days it's going to be all of that,
one
and
of
it's
days
that.
You're gonna fuck up. Yeah.
But I mean, because you know,
too much power.
Law of averages, you know, it's you can't keep making
good movies,
mostly good movies, who knows?
I don't know about that.
Yeah,
I think when directors make bad movies, it's because they're doing it for the money. And so far, I don't think Nolan has had to do that yet. I think if he ever,
Inception is the only one he didn't write. It was a remake. And that was probably
Inception?
His weakest. Yeah, not Inception. Remake. Inception Insomnia.
Yeah,
Insomnia. Insomnia.
And that was kind of like his get his foot. Because Memento, I mean, I just watched that recently, but Memento is still pretty indie. I mean, it was not like playing at the major theaters for the most part. Or if it did, it played quickly and all that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, have you seen the original
Memento?
No, Insomnia.
Yeah. I did a paper where I compared the two. You know. Not a lot of difference. I mean, he shoots the dog instead of finding a dead dog so that he can get the bullet as evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a little more, like, sexually stuff with, like, him and...
Skarsgård is pretty despicable.
He's despicable. And I don't think Al Pacino was.
Al Pacino was...
Well,
just
Al Pacino
was
kind of
like,
have that Al Pacino.
I'm a rough New York cop, you know? And Skarsgård was his, like, kind of sleazy stuff. Like, I'm going to take this teenager for a ride.
Well, in the end, too, was totally different, where Al Pacino was like, no, turn, you know, tell them the truth, and that kind of stuff.
It was
a
much more noble ending.
Yeah, and I will die, and you tell them the truth, whereas Skarsgård was like, frack, and he left.
Yeah.
Such a deep, like, the murderer falls off a pier and bangs it, and he's like, oh, well, shit, he's dead, and then he just did decide,
and then
he leaves.
And then the girl's like, I know who did it, and he's like... Oops. And then he leaves, and it's like fade out on his white eyes.
Yeah. I mean, that's a European thing, though, too. They love to kind of they seem to have decided a long time ago that depressing equals like art. Like every single time, and that's true. That, you know, it isn't art unless it deals with like issues of morality and mortality and everything else, but. It doesn't have to just be 100% dire and everybody's a scumbag.
So did you like Nolan's version better? Do you think that's a better version?
You know, it's been a long time since I did the paper and compared them. I don't know. Probably not.
To me, they feel very different in tone and the way they end. So to me, they're like almost...
I mean, obviously
they're both really good films.
Nolan is a more watered down version of...
Yeah.
Of that, it's like you took the European dark whatever, and you you lighten it up because you put in this actor, this Hollywood actor that everyone knows, kind of plays this kind of character.
You made Robin Williams the bad guy.
Yeah, you did that. Which I think they did that right when he was kind of in a spree of those. He was doing...
It was his first one.
He did One Hour Photo with Mark Romanek, just mm-hmm. the last
Which was after,
year.
Though. Yeah. Because I remember when Insomnia came out, everyone was like, oh my gosh, Robin Williams playing a bad guy.
Yeah, playing like kind of a creep.
So it was his first...
Which to me seemed to fit, because it always felt like he could be that. He could be kind of like a weirdo.
I always thought Robin was a little creepy, so to me...
Yeah, exactly. It's great. But yeah, so, I mean, you know, so we were just talking about people making different movies and... So, anyway, yeah, I would give the Lynch Dune. I don't know. I'd give it a 4, just because whatever anyone else. Yeah, 4 out of 5. Yeah, because whatever I always do out of 5. That way, there's always that buffer space of someone coming to be. Well, what about this, and this? And it's like, well, that's why I didn't give it a 5. Okay, I'm aware of flaws and that things can be different. I haven't listened to the podcast yet. It totally apparently does. Two guys that hate it. I'll have to see. Sometimes when people dislike stuff, it's interesting to see what they pick about it to dislike, and it can always seem really petty. I don't know. I'm sure they have perfectly... The things I like about it can are pretty superficial also. You know, I'm like, oh, I like that it's got the nice sets and whatever, you know?
Uh-huh. Those cool water suits and that Swedish accent
and everything. Yeah. Right. Jürgen. Oh, no, it's... what's his name? Yeah, he's in that, too. He's the Fremen leader. The guy that never dies because he's still alive. Yeah.
Max von Sydow.
Max von Sydow. Sydow. Sydow.
He's in everything.
He's in a lot of stuff. He was the king in Conan the Barbarian.
Oh, was he?
He was the guy that asked Conan to find his daughter because Thulsa Doom had taken her into the cult of the snake or whatever.
What movie was he in that we just watched? That Martin Scorsese film.
Shutter Island.
Yeah, it's like he's still acting. He's
fantastic. Holy moly, he was in that?
He was in Shutter Island. I've
seen it. I just don't remember him being in it.
The evil German doctor who's going to lobotomize you. You stabbed me.
That sounds about right. Yeah, I just watched Goodfellas on Blu-ray yesterday. It's always a classic. Anyway, yeah, so 4 for me, 4 out of 5. Malcolm?
It's interesting. I mean, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
But I wonder how high you should score a movie that you only want to watch like every 10 years or so.
I think you put it into how much you think you will enjoy watching it every 10 years. Because I don't think I'll watch it in another maybe 5 or 6 years, and on some Saturday night, and I'll probably enjoy the experience of watching it. Like I said, it'll be, if I'm in the mood for that kind of mood, it's perfect, you know? I mean, movies are like drugs. I'm serious. Everything is sensory experience, right? Yeah. Music, everything else. If you listen to it when you're in the wrong mood, you're not going to enjoy it as much. If you watch it when you're in the wrong mood, you're not going to enjoy it as much.
Yeah.
Things have to complement and have to work in the right fashion. So I don't think of, oh, you know what? Dune is a great movie on a, you know, depressing Tuesday when I've got a cold. Mm-hmm. I think, no, Dune is a good movie when I'm in this kind of mood to watch that kind of movie. So I don't know.
Rewatchability is high for me, which is why I gave whatever we did last time a 2. Because I would never rewatch it.
Total Recall?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Not a chick flick. It's just as easy peasy. So I mean, that's my stump speech about how to look at that.
Yeah.
Because there are those a couple movies every now and then. I used to have them when I was a kid. Like, where, you know, I think you do that more when you're a kid. You'll pop something on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And watch it over and over again.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I used to watch Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom, like when I get home from school, like a couple of times a month or something almost. Or the first Tim Burton Batman. I think mainly because we owned them on VHS and if I was bored. But I don't do that with hardly anything now, so.
I have a cooking movie.
A cooking movie?
Yeah, when I'm baking, I put on Oliver, the musical.
Oh, with Oliver Reed. And
I sing with it.
That's a good long movie. What are you baking a big old thing, huh?
Well, baking can take a while sometimes. Yeah. So you gotta raise.
That's right, baking cookies. I watched Ben Hur when I baked some cookies for a party
a couple months ago. That's a good long movie.
That's very long.
Except it's one of those things where you're like, you're trying to time it right, and so then you miss the critical scene while you're in there getting swapping the cookies out, and then you get back in.
There are certain songs where I want to be there to actually watch it, so I get
the choreography and everything.
Yeah. Off the top of the movie, is there a longest running movie?
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be, would it be like the longest running movie? Would it be?
I think the longest running movie is the Kenneth Branagh version of Hamlet. It's like four
really?
Plus hours. But I mean that's for
American.
A narrative. That's for like a U.S.
Okay.
narrative.
Yeah, we're
I'm
not
sure
talking Bollywood films.
What I'm
about
sure that
Artemis.
Stuff goes over.
That's a really long one.
I don't think that
is
goes
that
over 4 hours though.
Close to four.
Maybe it's in the high twos. Maybe it's three, even three. I don't know.
Same with Ben Hur. That's a long one, but I don't think it goes.
They all had intermissions back then. They were all like big event. All those big movies were crazy expensive, and they were big event things. So you were meant to go there, and that was what you did because you didn't have TV or you didn't have whatever.
Right.
So you go out to the show, and that would be your whole evening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you stop off at the diner and have a little Nighthawk moment, drink a cup of coffee, and. You know, smoke half a cigarette.
Half a cigarette or half a pack?
Yeah, half a pack. Whatever works. And then some platinum blonde dame would walk in looking just a little sad, and you'd have to wonder.
Looking like Rita Hayworth and you feel like James Cagney?
Whatever. Okay, I keep interrupting you. 4 out of 5 for me. Wait,
I'm going to give it a 3.
A 3 straight?
Yeah.
You know, you can do halves. I have to keep reminding people.
Yeah, I'll give it 3.5.
That's a good solid movie review. Yeah, I mean, it's, I'll check it out again. I liked it.
Yeah.
I'll give it a 3.
Nice.
Yeah, I like the star power in it, and it was fun.
Good. That was Lynch's Dune.